Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Today on the podcast, I am very pleased to welcome Dr. Eric Winsberg, professor of philosophy at the University of South Florida. Eric's principal interests are in the philosophy of science, the philosophy of climate science, and the philosophy of physics. He is especially interested in the role of computer simulations in the physical sciences and analog simulation in cosmology, and in the foundations of statistical physics and the direction of time. His work in the philosophy of climate science specifically relates to their application in science policy and ethics. He also writes on truth and on scientific authorship. He is the author of Science in the Age of Computer Simulation, which appeared in the fall of 2010 with the University of Chicago Press, and the co-editor of two forthcoming books, one on climate science and one on the arrow of time with the University of Chicago Press and Harvard University Press, respectively. When he's not tapping away on his laptop, you can often find Eric out on the water on his stand-up paddleboard. Thus, without further ado, let's bring in Eric. Dr. Eric Winsberg, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. It is a. How is it out there in University of South Florida?
Well, we're still kind of. We still have summer here. It's still pretty hot, so we're waiting for usually kind of towards the end of October for the summer to finally break.
Yeah, and you guys. So USF is in Tampa, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Great. Great. And how long have you been teaching there?
Wow, since 2001, so 16 years.
Fantastic. Wow. Had you ever been to Florida before?
Had I been here? Yeah. I think the first time was I came to Disney World when I was about maybe 10 or 11, so like 78 or 79, something like that. And I'd been here, you know, a few other different times, but I never thought it'd be the sort of place I would live.
Sure. Well, I see your photo. You've acclimated to that. I see you have you're in a shirt and board shorts on your profile page, about to go surfing, it looks like, or stand up paddleboarding, something like that.
Stand up paddleboarding. Yeah, we don't get much surf on the West Coast, so yeah.
Oh, that's right. Cool. All right. Well, I'm interested to hear of we're getting to the present at the point of what it's like in Florida, what you're up to, what philosophy of science is going down at USF. But before that, let's take a step back, and I'd like to know, Eric, where did you grow up?
So I was born in New York City, but we moved to Montreal when I was about 2 years old. So I mostly grew up in Montreal.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so was this from, from 2 until through?
2 to 15.
Through
school?
2 to 15?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What prompted the move from New York to Montreal?
Well, I was 2, so but, I just...
Well, and I know you weren't deciding.
No, but I think there, you hear different things about these things. I think, partly it was during the Vietnam War, Nixon was president, wasn't necessarily a great time to be an American, I guess. I think my father was a physician, and he was in a private practice that he thought he should have been made partner in by then. And he got a job offer in a hospital in Montreal. And it was, it was the opposite of private practice. It was, socialized medicine, working in a hospital, all that kind of stuff. And I think he wanted to give that a try. So.
Okay. That's great. So your father was a physician. What was your mother up to?
My mother had a kind of an interesting history. She went to graduate school in physics at Columbia in the 50s, which was a pretty intense time, I think, to be in the physics department there. There were, a couple of Nobel Prize winners running around. Steven Weinberg was a postdoc there, I think, at the time.
Oh, wow.
But she didn't finish her PhD there. She ended up going to work in some kind of a private lab on Long Island somewhere. I think it was actually, she worked for Gordon Gould, who is one of the inventors of the laser. And then she, she had kids and, I think stopped working at that point. We moved to Canada and she decided she wanted to teach physics in a kind of uniquely Quebecois institution, Cégep, which is a little bit like mandatory community college. Well, mandatory if you want to go to any kind of university.
Gotcha.
They told her that she had to have an advanced degree in education. So her master's in physics wasn't good, I guess. So she was going to go get her master's in education, and that all finally kind of snowballed into a career in what you might call psychometrics, I guess. She did kind of statistical modeling to try to figure out different aspects about human perception. So that was eventually ended up being her career.
Wow, that is fascinating. That is quite the career. So I imagine this has had somewhat of an influence on you in terms of your interest in philosophy of physics.
I think the main interest it had, I think, was, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I think my mom always, you know, at that, particularly when I was at a young age, she hadn't found the new career.
Yeah.
She kind of had regretted leaving physics and wanted, you know, very much wanted to kind of vicariously recreate that in me. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, just talk, I think when I was younger, that I would just obviously, you know, go into physics. That was going to be like my career or whatever. So,
yeah. Can you recall any instances or, you know, stories growing up about, you know, growing up and, you know, having folks who were really into, you know, not all folks have parents in academia that invested in these high level fields. So, you know, what was it like, I guess, having parents in physics doing things?
I'll tell you one sort of funny story, I guess, maybe get to your question. So this is, you know, these are things I obviously don't remember. My mother, I often heard her recount this story to other people that, when we were really young, and she had stopped working, she was, you know, very invested in, I don't even know how you count waves, but sort of, you know, basic first wave feminist kind of issues.
Yeah.
And just didn't want her kids to think that their mother was like a housewife or whatever. You know, she told us that what she was a physicist. She would like tell me when I was like 3 years old, oh, you know, your mom is a physicist. Supposedly when I was very young, I told somebody, you know, that my mom was a physicist in her presence. And then they asked what I thought a physicist did. And I said, oh, a physicist stays home and takes care of kids.
Oh, boy.
I guess that one backfired. But I don't know. I think, you know, my father was like an academic sort of physician.
Yeah, yeah.
Really the same thing as being, you know, it's not the same mentality as like being, you know, an actual academic that spends most of their time, you know, quietly at home, like researching or whatever. You're still, you know, at the hospital all day, seeing patients, all that kind of stuff. So if there was any kind of, you know, access to that academic world, it was much more through my mom.
Yeah.
But she was always, you know, she was always a little bit marginal to it because she got her PhD later in life. She didn't really, I think, you know, she's only really employed as a professor for maybe like 8 or 9 years before she actually retired.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it was this kind of weird, like half. It was this kind of weird, like half access to that, and a lot of just mostly what I mostly remember was a lot of desire to sort of vicariously recreate what she thought she maybe had missed or something like that.
Okay. So there was some active, you know, creation or, you know, sort of influence or discussions, regarding physics, regarding, you know, academic pursuits.
Absolutely. There was lots of like just sort of, you know, from her side, mm-hmm. Like active, you know, encouragement that was the kind of life that you wanted to pursue. And that, you know, everything was like, oh, how are we going to make sure that, you know, you can, this is what you'll do and how that you'll succeed at this or whatever. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's not often the case. A lot, you know, a lot of parents will encourage, well, this is, you know, those pursuits are great, but you need to go and make money or something like that.
On the other side, you know, my father was always like, you don't want to be a doctor. It's just that, you know,
oh, that's not yeah. Yeah.
he always kind of had a kind of, I think, slightly sour view of his profession. So that was, I think, pretty actively discouraged on the other side. So,
okay. Well, great. So, what were some of your interests growing up? What did you like to do or spend your time thinking about?
I guess, you know, it's just that those things last about what seemed like internally long, you know, 8 month periods when you're that age, I guess. But,
yep.
I definitely went through like a phase of being really interested in electronics. That was like, I guess, kind of a big thing in the 70s. You know, there was like Radio Shack and the little like Heath kits and the little like electronics kits where you would like wire up a transistor radio for yourself and all that kind of stuff. I was when like personal computers came out early on, I was of course really into that.
Did you get a computer was your first computer?
When was it? I don't remember exactly when it was, but what I got was a used Commodore PET that had it had 4 kilobytes of memory. It had a built-in little sort of chiclet-sized keyboard, a built-in tape deck for storing your data, which never worked, and a built-in kind of, I think it was green. No, it was white, actually, not green, just like a plain white text monitor that kind of stuck out of the body of the computer like a robot head. If you Google Commodore PET, you'll see a picture of what I'm talking about.
But. Yeah, I was looking it up. I think I had another guest on the show who's also into electronics, too. And yeah, these are great. These are awesome. Why didn't the tape deck work?
You'd all day trying to write a program that would draw a box or something like that. And then you would say, you know, you would type save. I don't remember, save, and then something that addressed the tape deck, and it would say press play or press record. So you'd press record on the tape deck, and it would kind of whirl for about 5 minutes and claim that it had saved the program. So then you'd turn off the computer, turn it back on, and you'd say load, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it would say, you know, you'd rewind the tape and it would say plus press play. And then it would just say searching, 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 searching. And it would get a file not found or whatever. I don't know. So, you know, it was pretty low fidelity. You were trying to record this onto, this was basically just the kind of tape deck that you would have had if you were, you know, a teenager wanting to listen to a, you know, cassette recording of, the latest, you know, top 10 band or whatever. It was a really cheap cassette tape deck. And it just didn't have, I think, the requisite fidelity to actually record the little squeaks and squeals that were the supposed to be the method of saving this data. It was always like fascinating to like save a program and then like play it on a normal tape deck, see what it sounded like or whatever. I think that was the only thing I ever got out of that tape deck.
Yeah, that's great. So doing some programming. Any other phases you went through in early adolescence?
Oh, you know, all the usual sort of nerdy stuff, science fiction, reading, and Dungeons and Dragons, and all that kind of usual stuff, I guess.
Oh, nice. Were you really into D&D
at the time? Not really into it, but we went through like a couple year period when we would
play
a fair amount. Yeah.
Cool. So. during this time, you know, and so this is in Montreal, and I should also ask, yeah, what was it like in Montreal growing up in Canada?
Cold.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, that's mostly I remember was that it was cold. It was also I've talked about this with people who grew up in the same time and place. It was an unbelievably permissive. Particularly with regard to how people raised their children. I think it was like we were, so I don't, there's this TV show that was quite popular last year called, I can't remember, Strange Things or Stranger Things. So those kids are exactly my age. One of the things I think they show quite well in the show is the kind of free range parenting that was like kind of popular at the time, where the kids are kind of just, you know, they all have like a key to the house around their neck and nobody's ever around. And you're just kind of, but Montreal was that, like, you know, just on steroids. I remember there was one year, it was when I was in fourth grade, and we started this new school, which was supposed to have like a fine arts curriculum, and they moved us into like one floor of a big high school that had kind of been losing enrollment, and they gave us, get this, this is fourth grade, they gave us like a college schedule where you had like a grid of days and times, and you just blocked out courses like anywhere from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. So, you know, when your recess was or your lunch period was just indeterminate, the same way it would be like if you were in college. But we were fourth graders. The net effect of this was, I think, pretty much the whole year, I must have gone to like 10 hours of class. So this is just to give you like a little bit of a taste of like
what
the kind of zeitgeist of child rearing in Montreal in the 70s was. It was like unbelievably like, you know, treating just, you know, like you were, I guess somehow people had gotten into their head that like you could treat fourth graders like adults and it would all turn out. which I guess, you know, it did turn out okay in some sense.
Sure.
There was definitely a lost year there, not having learned very much, to put it mildly.
Yeah. My own experience has, there was just certainly at the times, and probably as you understand now, there's a lot more structure typically built in. And as you bring up the story, that's interesting. I'm wondering if that's also, if that kind of permissive style in terms of in schools are still exists today, if there's, it's not exactly like a Montessori type of teaching. I mean, that's like a, you know, the freedom to come and go or kind of do what you want is.
I can't imagine that would ever exist anymore because of the kind of, I think more than anything else, the kind of media hysteria. I don't know exactly when it started, but there was this kind of media hysteria at some point about child abductions.
Oh, that's right.
And now I think like a lot of schools don't even let kids ride their bikes to school anymore or, you know, whatever. So,
Yeah, I can see that as definitely having some impact.
So, yeah, I don't know if you know this about Montreal, but because it's such a cold city, it's got this kind of whole network of, like, underground malls with, like, tunnels connecting them and all that.
No,
so you can kind of do all this stuff without ever going out into the frozen tundra. And, there was that kind of, that period around fourth grade, I don't remember exactly, but just, there was just an enormous amount of time spent just, you know, scurrying around these malls and tunnels and whatever.
So is this, so you had 8 to 5. I mean, you could just come and go as you please? Like,
yeah, and right, so, and if you were, you know, unlike any other normal school where there'd be fourth graders, if it was, you know, 10:45, and you were just in the hall throwing, you know, hockey card, I remember playing this game in fourth grade, we all had hockey cards and you'd kind of throw them against the wall and whoever was closest would keep both of them or whatever.
Yeah.
So you'd be out in the hall, like throwing hockey cards against the wall or whatever, when we were supposed to be in class. But if like the principal walked by or if anybody, it wasn't obvious that you were supposed to be in class because, you know, it might very well have been that was when your break was.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was a very unusual experiment, I think. But it just gives you a feel for like,
yo, that's super
weird. What the weird child rearing zeitgeist was at that time and place.
Oh, absolutely. So, as you're, exploring this, kind of permissive style, I mean, when did, was philosophy on the radar at the time?
I don't think I would have been able to give you even an inkling of what the word philosophy meant.
Sure.
Until I was a senior in high school.
Yeah.
So when I was 15, I think, as I mentioned earlier, we left Canada and we moved back to the New York area, but we actually moved to New Jersey. And we moved to a kind of like bougie suburb in Jersey, which was like the absolute opposite of this. So, you know, I started going to a high school in New Jersey where there was like, you know, a football team and cheerleaders and all that kind of stuff that like was completely alien to me when I got there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for whatever reason, like in my senior year, instead of taking English, which, you know, every year you take English, whatever that's supposed to be. And then in my senior year, you were allowed to take like these kind of humanities like electives. Mm-hmm. And one of them for one semester was called philosophy. I remember kind of liking it. I don't really remember what we did in that. I remember reading like some Mortimer Adler and some, I don't remember really anything else other than Mortimer Adler. Maybe, I'm blanking on the name, the kind of, American philosopher that said that truth was beauty. What's his name? One of these sort of wackier American philosophers. Anyway, I don't know why I can't think of the name. If I thought of it, you'd know exactly what I was talking about.
But yeah,
we read sort of weird stuff, but, you know, really like, you know, great booksy, like whatever kind of philosophy stuff or whatever.
Sure, and, sure.
And that, and you know, I kind of liked it better than 3 pages a day of The Grapes of Wrath or whatever we'd been doing in other English classes. But it definitely didn't register as something that I was interested in or that I would do when I got to college or anything like that. But right, that was, I think, the first time I ran across the word philosophy, probably.
All right. So what, you know, in high school, what were you, did you have ideas of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I wanted to, it was, you know, either like physics or engineering or some kind of physical science for sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So were like during, was it the physics classes that you were most interested in at the time, or at least even if not the classes, just that was what you were gearing toward?
Yeah, that's what, you know, all my teachers said I was good at. Mm-hmm. I was terrible. I was a terrible, terrible student in
really?
Any class that required you to write, to ever write anything or read anything. This was before people had computers or really, you know, you didn't have typewriters back then if you were just a student usually.
Yeah.
And my handwriting, as everybody who knows me knows, is like completely illegible. I was turning in my writing assignments would just be kind of Rorschach ink blots or whatever.
Yeah.
And, I never did very well in those kind of classes. And I just always thought like, yeah, I hate that stuff. That's not really like ever what I want to do. And,
What do you think it was about like writing and reading that just wasn't of interest at the time?
I don't know. I mean, these are, you know, one should always be weary of like pop diagnostics or whatever.
Sure, sure.
I sort of recently might have realized that I had pretty bad attention deficit disorder when I was a kid.
Okay.
And I just could never, I don't think I could ever really sit down and read something for very long.
Yeah.
And I just really, like, I was just always told that I was a horrible writer. You know, that I couldn't write, that this was like, you know, and, you know, I remember my mom even sort of saying things like, well, you know, this isn't really that important given what you want to do. But of course, you do realize that, you know, even engineers sometimes have to write little reports or something like that. So you have to have some, you know, basic minimal skills.
Yeah.
Right. So that just gives you a feel.
That's the reinforcement. Yeah. Yeah. Or just of. Yeah. Writing not being super valued, I guess, suppose.
Not valued. It's not important. You're not good at it.
That's tough.
Don't worry about that too much, but it might be a little bit of a problem if you're completely illiterate.
Okay.
That was kind of the message.
So still consider it, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it asked also, you sounded like the transition, from school in Montreal to school in New Jersey. How was that?
Well, like, they had an attendance office in New Jersey, and if you didn't go to class, they made a big deal about that. They called your parents, and they made you have detention and stuff like that, which was unlike what I was used to, which was you just sort of went to class if you felt like it and didn't if you didn't feel like it, and that kind of thing. And there were, you know, like I said, there were, like, sports teams, and people would go watch these sports teams play their sports, and none of this was, like, stuff that I was used to from,
sure.
Yeah.
Now, just curious, and then, you know, you related with how you didn't consider yourself that great of a student in certain areas, and, yeah, wondering how the transition might have affected that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't think that really, the transition in New Jersey didn't, I mean, other than, like, maybe now I had to turn in the homework a little bit more frequently than I might have, but it was still, I still, you know, didn't think that I was doing it very well and wasn't getting good grades at it and that kind of thing. So.
Cool. Right on. All right. So after high school, what was next? Did you apply, go to college, university?
University of Chicago.
Oh, great. Great.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, that's kind of where I think I discovered that, there were certain areas of the humanities where what you did was argue.
Yeah.
And I think anybody who knows me at all,
uh-huh.
could see why that was an enticing revelation that I could do, you know, that finding out that arguing was like a thing that you could do that would be academically rewarded.
Yeah. So what was your, before we get into that, like, you were someone who likes to argue, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I would have known that myself, uh-huh. but I mean, yeah, anybody that if you just sort of magically got a 1 hour videotape of a typical, like, you know, me on any particular time when I was 12, I'm almost positive there would have been a fair amount of, you know, arguing about almost anything. Nobody sort of told me, there was no indication that was a skill, you know, that you could have or that might be, you know, rewarded or anything. It was just like, it was just this annoying thing that you did or whatever that irritated people, you know.
That's great. So, yeah, so how did you come to learn this? Like, were there particular courses at UChicago, professors?
You learn that right away at Chicago, right? So, So Chicago, they make you take the Common Core,
mm-hmm.
and the Common Core includes a humanities sequence, you know, Hume 101, 102, 103, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in different flavors. But there was one that was called Philosophical Perspectives on the Humanities. It's possible that this high school philosophy course had the one causal role it might have played was it might have made me pick that particular flavor of humanities sequence. Maybe, I don't really remember. But anyway, so the first quarter of that I had Christine Korsgaard. A very young Korsgaard as a instructor, and you know, we read like the Platonic dialogues and Hume's dialogues on natural religion, and we, you know, argued about whether virtue could be taught or whether the design argument was good or whatever. And I liked it.
Awesome. Was there a particular area of philosophy you liked most?
At that point, I don't think I would have been able to tell you what the areas of philosophy were even necessarily.
Sure, yeah.
It was just that there were two things. One was there was this arguing that was going on that was really fun.
Yeah.
And the other was when I was getting like B's and C's on my writing assignments in high school, you know, I was now at, you know, a reasonably prestigious college.
Oh, absolutely.
The writing assignment would be something like reconstruct Plato's argument that, you know, I don't know, virtue can be taught or can't be taught or whatever. And so, you know, the writing assignment would be to write like premise one, premise two. And you didn't have to, I think we didn't, you know, we were discouraged from like writing, you know, flowery introductions or blah, blah, blah. It was just like writing was now, you know, this tool
Yep.
They used for doing things, and it wasn't just give me n many words that, you know, that go from. So all of a sudden I was like, oh, I actually can write perfectly well if it's in service of like making arguments, or, you know, as opposed to trying to write a short story or a book report on the Grapes of Wrath or whatever other kind of stuff they gave you to do in high school, you know.
That's great, actually. I really like that approach. I think a lot of those other kinds of, as you said, either flowery introductions and just like additional things, maybe some people are good at them, but they can detract away from the core of what you're actually trying to do.
Right, right. And I think Professor Korsgaard was I think a lot of people probably teach like that now, but I think at the time, maybe, and, you know, this was 1985, 1986, mm-hmm. that, you know, giving you writing assignments, really focused nuts and bolts writing assignments like that, I don't know if that was, that might have been a little bit avant-garde of her at the time. I couldn't really say, but yeah, it was really good for me, I think. And it was really good for me to all of a sudden be getting, you know, better grades on writing things. Think of it as a, you know, serious university than I was, you know, in a high school class. And also remember too, that, this is less the case now, but in my school days, whereas there were always these, like, you know, for science and math and that kind of stuff, there were always like different tracks. Like there was the honors track and the AP track and all that. They never had that for like English. You know, you were always, for English class, you were always like with everybody, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And even not even being honors or whatever, you know, I was getting crappy grades. So
yeah.
So it was kind of like, wow, I can actually get, you know, whereas I think I'd been pretty terrified that when I got to, you know, real university, like the writing assignments were just going to be way beyond me or whatever. So
yeah. And that can be discouraging, as you know, as a young student, as someone who, when you're like, oh, I'm, you know, not getting as good of grades in X subject or whatever. And that's kind of shapes what you think about yourself going forward. Right. So awesome to hear that. Had this really great experience with Dr. Korsgaard. So were you still doing, though? I mean, was physics and engineering still kind of the plan?
Yeah, well, engineering was off the table once I went to Chicago, because Chicago doesn't have any engineering. But yeah, so physics was definitely on the table. I think it was maybe sort of midway through my junior year where I started to think, like, I just don't know if I really want to do this. Which I think was at the time like a pretty difficult thing to contemplate.
What was going through your mind at the time?
There were just parts of it that I didn't like, parts of it that I was less good at than I thought I would be. I was terrible at anything in the lab.
Yeah.
I was terrible at calculating. Anything that where you had to kind of like, I'd set up the problem, I think, just right. But then when you had to like, you know, integrate something and there were a bunch of terms you had to keep track of, I was always, you know, I just couldn't calculate very well. And so that, you know, that aspect of it, which is mostly what they're teaching you in college, I just wasn't very good at it. So I just, you know, it was just causing me to be unhappy, I think. You know, I'd sort of started taking, I'd been taking all these other classes. In particular, I think that probably the most influential person on me then was Robert Richards. Bob Richards, right. Yeah, he was a very, very, very charismatic lecturer, you know. And I think by that time I'd had maybe two or three different classes with him. And I just, you know, I wanted to do what he did, which I didn't really realize at the time wasn't really a thing, because he was kind of really more than very many people you'll run into, both a historian and philosopher of science, you know. I thought there was a thing to do, HPS. And I wanted to do HPS. You know, that was kind of what I thought was exciting, was what he did. which I thought of as like history and philosophy of science.
Yeah, that's really, so I know, yeah Chicago has the CHSS program, the conceptual and historical studies of science, which is essentially HPS, maybe a little bit different. I'm not sure how, if they would agree, but it's, you know, for all intents and purposes, it kind of is. So was this going on at the time? Was there the CHSS program? Was
I think they HPS? Changed the name. So the graduate program then was called CFS, just Conceptual Foundations of Science.
Uh-huh.
That might have been probably like Howard Stein's name for it or something like that, maybe. But the undergrad major was called HIPS, History, Philosophy, and Social Studies of Science and Medicine. So that ended up being what I majored in, because in part because you could use all your physics and math classes towards that degree, plus all the other classes I'd already been taking out of interest. So that was an easy major for me to kind of patch together when I finally decided I didn't want to finish physics.
Understandable. Okay. That's great. So at the time, and then going through the HPS, was this, you decided you didn't want to do physics, but was academia, was that still something that you'd wanted to go into?
I think at that point, it was just, it had all fallen apart, you know? I was just...
Thanks for being on it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was going to do at that point. So it was just, you know, this thing that I'd sort of always thought I was going to do wasn't really on the table anymore, so...
Yeah, yeah.
It was just, you know, I was just in that normal state that a lot of people are in when they graduate college, which is, wow, now what?
Like so, the graduate, yeah. Like you're just like, exactly. Oh,
the graduate, or the more the one that was Reality Bites, I think, with what's her name?
I don't know if I've seen that one.
The actress, she's in Stranger Things. She's the mom in Stranger Things. What's her
Winona
name?
Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Oh wow, I got to see this. Yeah, Ethan Hawke, Ben Stiller. the post college. Yeah, sort of coming to realize everything wasn't exactly how you thought it was going to be. It's quite the experience. All right, so you know, during this time, you know, what occurred or transpired after then your time at UChicago?
I moved out to California.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in San Francisco for a year, and just did random stuff out there to kind of scrape together a living or whatever.
Well, how was that?
It was good. It was, you know, it had all those characteristics that, you know, that we were just talking about, those movies exemplify, you know, kind of, what am I doing? What's next? You know? It was a fun city to live in. Obviously it was the year of the big earthquake. I was out there for that. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I mostly remember,
you remember the earthquake?
I mostly remember it at some point thinking, well, maybe I should just go back to school, you know, because this doesn't seem all that fun either. So, the sort of the job prospects that are out here don't seem that fun. So, maybe I should just go back to school.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to ask, did you remember the earthquake by chance when you were...
Do I remember it?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Was it... what was it like?
I'd never felt an earthquake before in my life. Not even a... You know, this was a... I think, what was it? 7.2. I'd never even felt the 3.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had no idea what was happening. And I think I was in my room, in my bedroom. I'd just gotten home from work, I think, or whatever. And, I like walked out of my bedroom door and my roommates were standing in the doorways, which I guess is, you know, every Californian knows that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Nobody told me that. So I was like, what the hell are you guys doing? And they're like, dude, it's an earthquake. They're in the doorway. So yeah, that's mostly what I remember.
Okay. I've never experienced one myself, but I mean, I've heard it's pretty alarming to those of us who have, you know, I'm from Arizona, you're from Florida, probably more familiar with hurricanes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or no, you're not from Florida. I'm sorry. You're living in Florida right now. But New York, whatever. Well, there aren't a lot of earthquakes in Montreal. Yeah. All right. So time in San Francisco of not fun, but not the greatest, sounds like. Well, yes.
In terms of like, in terms of finding like a career, you know.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, you know, was this then the decision? Did you decide to go back to graduate school at this time or?
Yeah,
what was next?
I can't remember what the calendar was like at that point. I think I must have decided this by maybe January or something like that.
Okay, so pretty soon thereafter. All right, yeah. And you ended up which program?
Yours,
Indiana. That's right. Okay, yeah. Fantastic. And yeah, how was your time in good old Bloomington, Indiana?
It was great. I really enjoyed my time in Bloomington, I think. I mean, I was there for longer than one's supposed to be, I think, but I definitely enjoyed it. Yeah.
Okay. What was it? You know, I don't think we've had somebody on the show who's really been through the program here, you know, back in the 90s. What was your experience like? Why did you enjoy it so much?
Gosh, it's like, I'd have to break it down into so many little sub periods because it's such a, I mean, I was there, you know, from the age of 22 to 31, I think.
Oh, so you became a real local.
I've lived in like every part of Bloomington and, there was a period where I was not really doing graduate school. I was like,
yeah.
I was working for the, I don't know if they still call it UITS. Is that still a thing?
Yeah, UITS or UIT. Yeah. Yeah,
for them for a while. And so, yeah, there's just, I'd have to break it down into different periods.
Okay.
But I just thought it was a cool place to live. I thought the sort of the intellectual environment of the department was, it was, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, because I didn't know this at the time, but I think in retrospect, it was really quirky. In that, I think it was, I mean, it was sort of the ideal place to go to cultivate what I ended up cultivating, which was a kind of interest in doing philosophy of science of the kinds of sciences that weren't on the traditional menu of philosophy of science. It was kind of the perfect place for that.
Yeah, you could kind of do whatever you wanted, basically.
Yeah, it was not only that you could do whatever you wanted, but there were people doing quirky things. They just hired Stephen Keller, who was like, you know, working on philosophy of chaos theory.
Oh, wow.
But then also there was so much sort of intermingling between the historians and the philosophers that you didn't really, it kept you from being kind of really enculturated in the, you know, normal philosophy of science canon in the way that you would have been, I think, other places. So it seemed less weird, I think, there to say, oh, I'm going to write on computer simulation.
For listeners who aren't super familiar with sort of what is expected, how would you describe like the normal philosophy of science canon versus this other sort of more quirky approach?
Well, I mean, you just have to look in like, you know, the PSA proceedings of the era. And there would have been probably six sessions on quantum mechanics, right? Some on like space-time theories. Don't really think there was even very much stat mech being done at the time. That caught back on after David Albert's book came out around the turn of the century. And then there was traditional general philosophy of science topics that had been around since the 60s, you know, I mean, like explanation and progress and confirmation theory. And so there was, a much more... My recollection, anyway, I could be wrong about this, but my recollection was there was a much more, a fairly smaller menu of, you know, sort of topics that you were supposed to work on.
Yeah.
Of course, there was growing, very, very much growing philosophy of biology, which I sort of forgot, but that was not, you know, that not something I was going to be involved in. So,
right. But there wasn't, you know, philosophy of computer simulation. There wasn't, you know, the climate science wasn't, you know, investigated. The climate science, you know, wasn't its own subsection, perhaps, at the PSA. I don't know if it is now, but it very well could be.
Yeah, we've had subsections on climate science PSA, but no, that was unheard of.
Yep.
There wasn't this idea of like philosophy of science in practice, or people were talking a little bit about philosophy of experiment, but nobody mm-hmm. really knew what that was other than hacking, I think. I think at the time in the sort of early to mid 90s, I thought Ian hacking was like, you know, that was the thing that you wanted to emulate, which was, I think, also a little bit unusual.
Mm.
I just, you know, I wanted to do something kind of something like what he did, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, if you could put it into words, you know, you've talked about, I want to be like Bob Richards. I want to do like what Ian hacking does, you know, so what is it that you kind of wanted to do, I suppose? Like what was your goal in terms of, I suppose the question is doing good philosophy of science. What did that look like for you?
So to me, doing good philosophy of science at the time meant opening its eyes to, and I think this was the sort of feature of hacking that I liked, you know, opening the eyes of philosophy of science to the richer set of scientific practices that were out there than I took it to have been aware of in the preceding, you know, 50 or 60 years or whatever.
Mm. Okay.
Whatever that might mean, whether that meant, you know, uncovering different styles of explanation than people had looked at, or uncovering different sources of evidence than people had looked at. Hacking was talking a lot about different styles of reasoning, whatever he exactly meant by that. But just kind of that was this kind of, I think, thing that some people were kind of trying to do in the maybe late 80s or into the 90s was like, look, isn't science a much more, you know, many faceted thing than we've given it credit for, or something like that.
Is this in line with like the naturalistic turn, or is this something kind of a separate?
I guess that's fair. I probably wouldn't have been particularly in tune with that phrase at the time, but
sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, and maybe even sort of, I mean, I do think you see something specifically that goes a little bit beyond that, which to the richer set of practices that were out there that have not been investigated. I think that's something, right. You know, perhaps you could use the methods, you know, study this, doing philosophy of science as like a science itself. But the way in which the kinds of things you're looking at could be very different.
Right.
Who was your advisor at the time?
So the department kind of went through a huge upheaval while I was there, which was, I think, maybe one of the many reasons I was probably there for longer than one's supposed to be in grad school. The person who ended up directing my dissertation was Michael Friedman.
Okay.
But also, Fred Suppy kind of showed up,
mm-hmm.
In the later few years that I was there. And he also was, kind of like a co-advisor on the dissertation. But a lot of it was just me kind of, you know, I don't know, what does the prodigal son do before he returns? You know, having kind of just wandered off, into the wilderness, and just kind of, you know, floundering around, wondering how I was going to do this until I kind of came back and was like, okay, here, now I know what I'm doing, and will you guys advise me or whatever? So,
okay. And so you described this upheaval. Was there just like a big flip, just a lot of faculty leaving, a lot of.
Yeah, that's right. There were just a lot of people retired or left or whatever. Sure. And then, but then also, you know, the department hired Michael Friedman in 94, 95, and he came there. He came there with an agenda to kind of rebuild the department in his image and all that. So there was a bunch of fires after he came, and So yeah, it was the department went through a huge transition associated with his hire, I think.
Cool. So if you in a few in a very short time, could you describe a little bit about your dissertation research and sort of the main questions that you were asking?
I really only had one question. Cool. And it was, how can I write a dissertation on computer simulation? How can I make this a philosophical topic?
Yeah.
And a lot of people were telling me that that you couldn't, that it wasn't really that it wasn't the sort of thing that was, susceptible to philosophical study.
Yeah.
So I was mostly just kind of fishing around for how I could do that. And I think my earliest thought on that was, it's got to do with the kinds of explanations people are trying to get with computer simulations, because it seemed to me that there was this obvious weirdness going on, which was that, of course people had lots of criticisms of Hempel's account of explanation or whatever, but the basic idea that explanation was, bringing a phenomena under the domain of some theory in whatever way was what it was to explain it, seemed to be kind of something that most people agreed on. And yet so much of computer simulation seemed to take place where you already, you already began by thinking you knew what the right theoretical resources were for tackling some phenomenon. And then you were doing it to sort of learn something else about the phenomenon. And I thought that was worth remarking on. And as I started trying to make that point, I think some of my advisors, I think Michael in particular, kept wanting to know, well, what do you think is the relationship between these, these phenomena and the theories? And that, I think, ended up being a bulk of what I really wrote about. Although there was lots of stuff in the dissertation about explanation in the end. None of that's ever gotten published. None of that's ever really ended up being anywhere. Uh-huh. But that stuff about when you do computer simulation of complex systems and you start with some theoretical understanding of the system that you use to make the simulation in the first place.
Yep.
What relationship do you end up with between theory and phenomena? And that's what I ended up writing about in the early part of the dissertation. Uh-huh. And that's the stuff that I think I ended up being the first few papers that I published on the topic. Cool.
So these papers like sanctioning models or I believe I read simulated experiments in a recent course.
All three of those papers are somewhere in the domain of that question. So what is it? Sanctioning models, simulations, models, and theories, complex physical systems and their representations. And then the one that was in the main, that second one was a PSA, PSA proceedings kind of turned into philosophy of science around that time. So it was in philosophy of science, but it was the supplement or whatever. But then
the one that was
in real philosophy of science was the simulating experiments, methodological, whatever. But I can't remember the title.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. All right. So, so it sounds like, so you've managed to, turn, your interest in some of these other things like computer simulations into an actual career. What came about next after your dissertation? Were you on the job market?
I was on the job market, and it was by far the most depressing.
Oh, no.
it was unbelievably brutal. I mean, there was
how bad was it?
So it was bad. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing at that time. I don't know whether other departments were better, but nobody told me anything about how you were supposed to do this.
Yeah.
So I sent a bunch of applications, which people probably thought were appalling when they saw it. and I got one interview at the APA that year, and it was Notre Dame, which was like, I'm not going to get this job.
Like the very strong school.
So that was So that was a disaster. And then, I think I was at some conference somewhere, maybe in Italy, I think. Huh. And I met Mauricio Suarez for the first time. Mm-hmm. And, I was telling him about the job market or whatever. And he's like, well, have you applied for any postdocs? And I was like, postdoc? What is this? I mean, I've heard of postdocs in science, but what are postdocs?
Like philosophy. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And he's like, well, I was last year the postdoc at Northwestern with Arthur Fine. Yeah. Did you apply for that? And I said, you know, no, I never heard of that. What are you talking about? And then I think we like went on the internet right then and looked it up, and the deadline was that day.
Wow.
So I emailed, I mean, I didn't know Arthur Fine at all. I never met him, but, wow. but he was the advisor of this guy, Stephen Kellert, who I was, you know, pretty tight with at the time. So I emailed Arthur and I said, hey, you know, I just heard about this postdoc. I just saw the deadline is today. Is there any way I can still apply for this? And somehow, I don't know, he was like, you know, yes, like get it to me in the next like 3 days or whatever. And he said something like, make sure your letter writers get in touch with me. And I think I probably misinterpreted that phrase. And I think what he meant was make sure that they get me your letters. But somehow I read it as they need to call me.
Sure.
So I was on the phone, like, you know, calling Michael Friedman and calling Fred Suppy and calling everybody. You need to call Arthur Fine. You need to call Arthur Fine. And I think the net effect of this was that I got the postdoc. I think Arthur was like, oh my God, this guy must be amazing. Like everybody's calling me about him. So I got the postdoc at Northwestern and I did that.
Cool. How was that?
It was great. I mean, it was both fantastic, but of course, like it was a 1 year postdoc originally. Uh-huh. And, so immediately, you know, you get there in September and then in October, like the job applications are due again.
So you're, you're back immediately doing the job. You're
back in that doomed state that you were in the year before.
Yep.
And, I did again miserably on the job market. I think I had maybe a couple more interviews, but, no flyouts, you know, no campus visits again. And both of these years, both in my last year of graduate school and then the next year when I was in Chicago, even more so, I was like starting to like email people in the business world.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Like trying to get like, what else can I do? Because this is not going to go anywhere.
Well, it's often the case that, you know, I've spoken with many, you know, other philosophers in confidence that during their graduate years, during the time, you know, certainly other, you know, they're considering other professions at the time because just understanding the reality.
I don't think that was me. I didn't understand the reality. I just got the panic state at the end.
Sure. You're just like, where can I go? Yeah.
So I hadn't planned for this at all or whatever, but I just had worked for, UITS. So I had like some,
You have some skills. Yeah.
Not really, but I can't like get people to talk to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then at some point, maybe March or April of my first postdoc year, Arthur just, he was amazing. And he just said, well, I talked to the dean and, I asked if it's okay for us to give you the postdoc for another year. And, and I did that. And then the next year, finally, I think I had enough stuff out and whatever that I got more interviews and whatever.
So as a postdoc, what is expected? Because it's kind of like you've heard of postdocs in the sciences. And in the sciences, it's often the case that you're kind of, you take a more senior role in a laboratory where you might be a little bit more be gaining some first authorship. It's almost like a rite of passage now in the biological sciences where you really can't get a job without a postdoc, or at least that's kind of the way it's going. Not the case in philosophy, but you know, there's no lab to run in philosophy, so to speak. So
no, you don't have any. I mean, they gave me some very small amount of teaching to do. Sure. I think it was Northwestern's on the quarter system, and I think it was like one quarter class a year.
Oh, okay.
And maybe some other little thing. But no, that's it. That, other than that, they just, you know, give you an office and tell you to
do some work.
Do your work. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, And I mean, but you know, we did so Matthias Frisch was an assistant professor there then, and David Hull was still there for my first year there. And we had a bunch of reading groups, and we had a bunch of there were a bunch of great talks, and then there was the Chicago area philosophy of physics group, and
great.
And there was one talk that we went to that was John Jarrett gave a talk, and then Arthur and I ended up writing a paper together on quantum separability after that. And there was between Arthur and Matthias, both of whom had, I think, you know, just for my taste, fantastic sort of philosophical sensibilities.
Yeah.
It was a great time.
Phenomenal. And so then it came the time that you were managed to get some interviews and, University of South Florida called?
They called. I think I was their third candidate in their preference.
Okay. Hey, that's top three. It's pretty good.
Top three is fantastic if the top two don't want the job, which they didn't.
Yep.
So here I ended up, and I've been here. I mean, I've been off around the world in a couple of different places.
Visiting fellowships and whatnot.
Yeah, I've been in California a bit, and I've been in England a bit, and I've been in Germany a lot. But I've been here. Other than that, I've been here a long time now. So,
That's great. And perhaps telling me you've been there for several years. What are maybe one or two of your favorite research projects you've worked on at USF?
That's almost everything in some sense. Okay. So. Everything having to do with climate science has happened, since I've been here. That's been pretty exciting. And, all my interest in, I did a few papers in foundation statistical mechanics, in the kind of the mid aughts. That was all here. That was pretty fun. I taught a class on truth here I co-taught it with Rebecca Kukla back in 2008. And then we wrote a paper together on, it's called, deflationism, metaphysics, pragmatics, and semantics. It's something like that. But anyway, we basically kind of go through a variety of views that claim to be deflationary, and we sort of point out ways in which they're not. And we say that this is what it really is to have a kind of deflationary account of truth and reference and meaning and all that. So that was pretty fun. That was just not really the kind of stuff that I was ever really trained to work on or really ever even knew about until I just started reading enough that I thought I would teach a class on it.
SHU Chicago. And I think this is an interesting part of your story that I've traced, I guess, throughout your experiences, like these very different, structurally different and intellectually distinct areas of environments, from literally from elementary school to high school to then U Chicago to then this quirky Indiana. So what was USF like?
USF was not anything like so for one thing, it was the first time that I'd been in a philosophy department in my life. So Northwestern is a philosophy department, but my postdoc was in the program in HPS. And my grad school was in HPS, and my undergrad was not a philosophy major. And so I know I'd never taken a class in ethics, for example. I'm not sure I'd ever been to an ethics talk in my life until I went to USF. I remember getting here and I remember telling somebody that I didn't know who Bernard Williams was. And they were like, "You got to be kidding me." And I was like, "No, I'm not sure I know who Bernard Williams is."
I love it.
And then funnily enough, he ended up coming here and giving us a talk at USF right before he died.
Oh,
but I think it might've been, I wouldn't be surprised if it was his very last thing he ever did.
Yeah, sure. It looks like he passed away in 2003. I looked him up. So
is that right? I would have thought it was.
June 10th, 2003, at least according to Wikipedia.
So I, Okay, that would have been at the very end of my second year, right? So yeah, he must have come here in the spring of my second year. But anyway,
So there was some acclimation to like what it would have been.
Some acclimation to what it was like to be around other philosophers who did things like ethics or history of ancient or I've been very used to being around people who did history of ancient science, let's say.
Sure.
But not people who worked on, Aristotle's Politics or anything like that. So that was a lot of acclimation. And also the other thing with the other acclimation was I'm always sort of the this goes back to the thing, I said right at the beginning of the interview about being the annoying argumentative kid. I'm always the contrarian, right? So
yeah.
So when I was like at Indiana or whatever, I was the, Ian Hacking reading Enemy of Reason, when I got to USF, where there were a lot of people interested in continental philosophy and that kind of stuff, then I was like, all of a sudden that turns me into Carnap, So I'm always just the opposite of what everybody
else. Whatever they're going to do, you're like, nah, I'm not going to go with you. We're going to try something else.
I'm just going to be a pain in the ass and just take the opposite view of whatever you have. Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Did you find, that being in a philosophy department shaped the way in which you did HPS a little bit? I know there's always this split between folks who are, who are concerned regarding the potential disconnect between philosophy of science and then more traditional analytic philosophy, or I suppose continental philosophy here. We don't even really talk about the connection between continental philosophy and philosophy of science too much. Is there anything you could say to that?
I don't think so. I mean, other than this thing I've already mentioned that, I got this interest in deflationism, and cultivated that with Rebecca. I don't think it really affected my philosophy of science that much. I think maybe just the fact that I was now unequivocally a professional philosopher, as opposed to something that doesn't exist, like, a professional HPSer or whatever.
Yeah.
That meant that I now had to pay a little bit more attention to doing stuff that was, unequivocally going to go in philosophy journals, might be accepted at the APA or whatever. Maybe a tiny bit that,
sure,
that made me want to do some of the StatMech stuff, which is a little bit more traditional than my say simulation or climate science stuff.
Sure.
But that would have been a minor effect.
Yeah. So in terms of philosophy of science, you're right. Maybe it's more so like, for example, in your bio, you write, you've written on truth. I imagine deflationary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what does that look like? Like what kinds of, that project, what did that look like?
Oh, there's just this one paper that we did. Like I said, one of the things, I guess there were two things that we were interested in, two claims that we thought a lot of people believed in the literature that we thought were wrong. And we wanted to, say so. One was that there's this, I think all Pittsburghians, which Rebecca very much is, was a Pittsburghian, believe that, Grover Camp and Belknap is the consummate, deflationary account of truth. And, we wanted to point out various ways in which it's not at all deflationary.
Okay.
It doesn't really hold up to, what we took to be the, sort of canonical things that a deflationist should believe. And the other was, a lot of people seem to be claiming that deflationists couldn't separate discourse into the factive and the non-factive. And we thought that was wrong. We wanted to point out why. So then it ended up being that a lot of the paper was just saying as clearly as we could what it was to be a deflationist. Because obviously both those questions hinge on that. So
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. So would you mind catching, let's jump up to the present. What kinds of projects are you working on now?
Well, I'm really just finishing up right now a pretty big project, which is a book on, the book's going to be called Philosophy and Climate Science. I just turned it into Cambridge.
Congratulations.
Maybe a month ago. I mean, now I'm doing the kind of, filling out questionnaires for the blurbs and hopefully getting the page proofs soon and making the index and that kind of stuff. So that's not, that's occupying some of my time, but it's not really it's not very intellectual anymore.
Sure.
I don't really know exactly what's next, although there are plenty more sort of loose ends about climate science. There's different arguments that I'm in with various people that need to be kind of settled or whatever.
Yeah. What kind of book is it? Do you have a main claim that you're putting through, or is this an edited volume?
So I think to some extent, I'll say this out loud on the record, maybe, I guess. I think to some extent, like David Albert's books are kind of were my model. So, particularly his quantum mechanics book, but also the StatMech, I think is well known for being extremely pedagogically useful and also, serious research contributions. And I wanted my book to be like that. I wanted it to be the kind of book that if you wanted to teach a grad seminar on philosophy of climate science, it would be a course in a box for you pretty easily.
Yep.
It's got 13 substantive chapters. That's not, an accident. That kind of usually matches how many weeks I plan if I'm planning a seminar. It starts off, the first few chapters, if you know any philosophy of science, you're not going to learn any philosophy of science from the first few chapters. And if you're reasonably knowledgeable about climate science, you wouldn't learn that much from those chapters either. But then it gets more and more kind of, less and less introductory as you go, and more and more, it gets more and more polemical and expressing my views rather than just kind of what I think any philosopher of science would say about climate science, which is kind of how I wanted the first few chapters to go.
Cool. Did you find it helpful to review or to write these introductory chapters at all? Was it sort of like a more just, okay, this is what I have to do to get through to get to what I really want to write?
Oh no, writing is always, anything you write always affects you.
Yeah.
There's no way you can write a chapter on anything, and not have it affect how the next chapter is going to come out. So yeah.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. I guess that in the next year or two, maybe you want to see. I'm not sure the book publishing. That's very soon.
June 2018. Yeah, I think that's my hope right now.
Well, and I imagine there's more and more courses that should come up in the philosophy departments on climate science. So hopefully that will be picking up your book. And All right. So any other directions or thoughts on what's next, or kind of?
They're too inchoate. I think if I tried to express any of them,
that's fair.
myself. So yeah.
All right. That's cool. Okay. So well, let's get to my final question of the interview. I've taken a lot of your time, but thank you so much for hanging out. Basically, I'm curious as to what do you see as the greatest challenges facing philosophers of science today.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think the challenge of philosophy of science is always the same one in a nutshell. And it's that you want to be constantly doing new things. You want to be fresh and interesting. You want to be engaged with things that are of contemporary relevance. And that doesn't matter whether that's, that means climate science, or that means inflationary cosmology, or that means, dark matter, but the things that, you know, you don't want philosophy of science to just be still debating things that von Neumann talked about in the 1930s or whatever. Of course, that's still, you know, the measurement problem is still, of course, an important issue, and we still don't know what the right thing to say about is. So that's, of course, still important. But you also, I think, want to be engaged with things that scientists are engaged with. But at the same time, you want to avoid one of the dangers of doing, what people sometimes call philosophy of science in practice, or whatever, which is to just be kind of doing a reportage of the science, because that's not, that's not super interesting as philosophically. So you've mentioned
philosophy of science in practice. Can you maybe describe? I've also seen calls for papers for this. I actually am not super familiar with what it is. So
I don't know what people. I don't know exactly what other people mean by it. It's not a phrase that I would have picked exactly.
Yeah.
But to me, it just means staying engaged with actual science, as opposed to having kind of branched off from science some number of decades ago, and then, you know, insularly pursuing that approach or whatever. I think to me, as long as you're I think maybe some people think of it as like, well, there's foundations on the one hand and there's in practice on the other hand. To me, that's not exactly right. David Wallace, I thought, gave a great talk at the APA that was supposed to be philosophy of physics in practice. And David Wallace is interested in the most foundational stuff in quantum mechanics. But what he did was he looked at how people use quantum mechanics in the wild, as he put it, what can we learn from that about what the right foundational approach is, pro tip, it's going to be Everett, I thought that was a great talk, and I don't think has to be any contrast between foundations and looking at practice or whatever, but I guess to me it's just that the challenge is always like to be engaged with, new and interesting science, and keep it philosophical, not have it just be, I have this case, let me tell you about it. And I'm not just pointing that finger at other people. I think some of my work, sometimes if I look back at it, looks disappointingly like that to me. I'm like, this isn't really that philosophical. I wish I'd been, more whatever here or something like that. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. So I guess, so what does it mean just to keep it more philosophical to you? Because sometimes it feels like if you're necessarily going to then get into the practice of it, then the focus might be more on less on the philosophical problems or issues. But what does it mean to you?
If there were a short answer, it wouldn't be the main challenge.
Yep.
I think it's in each case, it's going to have to be something, some creative new way of making it philosophical. And that's what makes it to me, the most interesting to my mind. That's always, I really like foundations of physics. I'm not smart enough to do it myself, very much, at least. I love staying active in that community and being able to understand the talks and all that. I love that stuff.
Cool.
But the kind of stuff I think I'm best at, that I do well, is more this kind of, being engaged with new science or whatever. Yeah. And I think what makes that hard, unlike say in the other case where what makes it hard is it's really hard problems. What makes doing this stuff harder is you got to be a little more creative about making things philosophical or whatever. So I don't know.
There's not a short answer. I would just, I just wasn't sure if you had any ideas, but I kind of, it's often a time of exploring, trying new things. You sometimes know it when you see it, or you can distance between things. Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat, Eric. Is there anything you wanted to add or to plug in terms of, the department or new work or, anything else you wanted to mention?
Buy the book. It's going to make a great Christmas present. I don't know.
Yep, 2018. Pre-order it now. Okay, great. Well, thank you again, Dr. Eric Winsberg, for the time and the chat. I hope you have a wonderful a wonderful rest of your day and a wonderful fall semester.
All right, you too. And thanks again for having me on.
Of course. All right, talk to you soon.
All right, take care.